And I was born in a tented refugee camp as a result of that. I am the son of the Nakba. And now we are the victims of the victims, but who is the victimizer? Was it the Palestinian people?
Could you have seen perhaps a realistic mass integration of Jewish people into Palestine where they would co-inhabit it?
In the Israeli army, there are Muslim soldiers, there are Christian soldiers. This is not about the identity of our oppressors. This is about the fact of our oppression.
What does a two-state solution look like to you, and how can you work with an Israel which is basically unwilling to remove settlements in West Bank?
Many people think the two-state solution is a Palestinian demand. Wrong. The two-state solution is a Palestinian concession. Such a people who have been able to do this despite all that, can you imagine, can you begin to imagine how Palestine will become such a force of good should Palestine be free?
This is Critical Edge. Today we're here with Ambassador Hussam Zomlot, head of the Palestinian mission to the UK. He's been a vocal advocate for the Palestinian cause since a young age and now works closely with Mahmoud Abbas, head of the PLO, that is the Palestine Liberation Organization. Hussam, thanks so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Lucas.
One question we like to begin all our interviews with is, when was the last time you changed your mind about something important?
Oh, every day. I change my mind a lot. But the first time that I changed my mind was when I was rather a child. About what my people have gone through and how this has been done without any real pushback by the international community, by the surroundings. And that really propelled me to engage more in public life and in the pursuit of justice for our people. And that moment was a very vivid moment of my life, which was the first intifada. That has really made me change course.
So maybe just for our listeners, what about that situation and the first intifada made you change your mind?
Well, I came to close sort of contact with the occupier, because up until then I was a child. I was shielded by my community, by my parents, by the refugee camp I was born in, shielded in every sense. But then by then I was on my own in the school, and the first intifada erupted. I went out with my colleagues, the students, in a march. And then that was the first time I see the Israeli military, the Israeli occupation forces in action, shooting live bullets against, you know, peaceful demonstrators. It was a march. I remember 6 being killed that day, all unarmed, all peaceful demonstrators. I saw some of them. And then I was myself arrested and beaten that day. And that really shaped a lot of my thinking about the need to actually change that reality. That reality we cannot live with, we cannot accept, we cannot accommodate. And it's not just a matter of national considerations, but it's also personal. I mean, it brought me back to why I was born in a refugee camp, what happened before to my parents and grandparents. So that vivid moment did make me take a firm decision that a life worth living is going to be in the pursuit of justice for our people, for my people, and that life has to be spent on the defense of their rights. And that decision was truly, truly motivated by my love as a child for my community rather than hatred for anything else. Because we grew up in a refugee camp that we saw the solidarity of our neighbors, our people, the collective experience, the support of one another. And as a child, I say it from time to time, we were spoiled as children, as refugees, by our community to try and compensate us for the fact that we were born in refugee camps, in tents, without any substantial material or governmental support for that matter. So the love that grew in your heart, I mean, has been a main determinant of the journey that followed.
Thank you, Hussam. It's powerful and it's emotional as well. And I think emotion is an important part of the history, what's going on now as well. I wanted to read you a poem or an extract of a poem by Mahmoud Darwish, a prominent Palestinian poet. And you can just give your reaction to that and any thoughts that you may have. That's okay. So it's called To Our Land, and it reads, "To our land, and it's the prize of war, the freedom to die from longing and burning. And our land in its bloodied night is a jewel that glimmers for the far upon the far and illuminates what's outside it. And for us inside, we suffocate more."
Well, that's a very powerful poem by a very powerful national poet of ours. Mahmoud Darwish is ingrained in the hearts and the minds of the millions of Palestinians and the millions upon millions of the supporters and friends of Palestine, because he was able to capture the real story and capture the feeling, the feelings of his own people, and no, like no one else could. And here, the land is our jewel. The homeland is our jewel. Here it is. Because many, many in the West particularly, have been portraying the conflict and the situation as if it is based on hatred and on rage rather than on love of the land, love of the people, and love of one's rights. And commitment to one's rights to be equal. And such poem tells you all what you need to do. There is so much love between any Palestinian and the land and the heritage and the people and the community, which have been the main motivation behind that 100 years struggle that Mahmoud Darwish is an integral part of. And if you go back to his poem, his poems, you will find out a great deal of love and attachment to the mother, to the grandmother, to the neighbor, to the landscape, to the history, to Palestine being the cradle of civilizations, the birthplace of Christianity, a significant sacred place to all Abrahamic religions. The bridge between East and West, a hub, a true hub. And that is exactly what shapes, motivates the Palestinian people. It is the love of, not the hatred towards.
Thank you, Hussam. Let's talk a bit about that then, because you said the first Intifada, beginning in 1987, was the first time that you sort of engaged with the politics in a wider sense. But nonetheless, you were born in a tented refugee camp just on the border of Palestine. You said even when you were younger that you thought the UN flag was your flag. Why don't you tell us, even before the first Intifada, what that taught you about Palestine, that experience, and what that taught you also importantly about Israel?
As a child, the thing that was most vivid is the community, is the people, is the family, is your parents, grandparents, your aunts and uncles, your cousins, but also your immediate neighbors, because a nation that has gone through the Nakba, which is the events of 1947 until 1948, whereby two-thirds of the Palestinian people were ethnically cleansed from their homes and livelihoods, what have you. And I was born in a tented refugee camp as a result of that. I am the son of the Nakba, like millions of Palestinian refugees. But the one thing that would always live with us as a Palestinian refugee, the one thing is the love we got, the care we got, the support we got from our community. It's unparalleled. Unparalleled. I'll tell you that. I always make it sound like a joke, but it's not. That as if one mother is not enough, I had 20 mothers in the refugee camp. Everybody cares about everything. Everything is communal, because that nation, that ancient rooted nation, has lost its material base to Israel in 1948. Their land, our land, was taken and stolen. Our homes, our properties, our businesses, our farms, everything was taken. So they lost the material base, and therefore what left was the human side. What left was the investment in the human capital. And that's exactly, how can I describe for you, a life in the most adverse, difficult situation imagined, intense, but a life full of love and full of solidarity and full of communal being and existence. Like in the refugee camp, you only have one home, one phone, in the neighborhood, one TV. So we all go to watch TV in that home, and everybody uses the phone in the other home. It happened that the phone was in my home, but the TV was in the other home. But that life teaches so much love. It teaches you so much collective being and collective commitments. And it teaches you that it instills in you that everything you do is because you have so much love to give back to the people who gave you so much love and investment on the way to where you are today.
Thank you. Very briefly, before we talk about the wider historical context, could you tell us about your family's experience specifically in the Nakba, in the experience in the events of 1947 and 1948?
My family come from a village by the name of Simsim to the north of Gaza Strip. And my family has gone through what 2/3 of the Palestinian people have gone through. They were attacked by Zionist militias at the time. Massacres were happening all around them. and at one point, they had to take the decision what to do with their children and grandchildren. And unfortunately, the same decision has been made by the same refugees yet again. This is the first time maybe in modern history that refugees are made refugees, not only once, not only twice, but multiple times. This is the first time. This is the first time an entity that is Israel is still targeting the very same people it targeted 76 years ago. Not once and not twice again. And you see what is happening. People need to remember that Gaza, 80% of the population in Gaza are refugees like myself. So the very same people that are being displaced now as we speak, their parents and grandparents have been displaced, have been ethnically cleansed from their homes, mass expulsion. So my family was part of that. And my grandfather took the decision to try and protect his children from the shellings and the indiscriminate killings all around them to walk southward. And together, my father at the time was just a child, a toddler, together with his all of his sons and daughters walked southward to try and protect his family as far as possible from the atrocities committed by the Zionist militias. But he had one red line as they were fleeing, trying to protect his family from the atrocities. The one sort of commitment he had in his heart is that he wants to go as far as possible from the atrocities and the brutality and the mass killings, but not outside the homeland. He wants to stay in the homeland. And the furthest point of Palestine to the south is Rafah, and there I was born. So he kept walking and asking his fellow Palestinian refugees, displaced people, are we still in Palestine? And they would answer him, yes, we are in Palestine. And he kept asking that question until he got to a point, he asked that question and the answer came, yes, but if you take a few steps, you will be in Egypt. There I was born. He decided to build his tent there. To the very south of Palestine, but he still wanted to stay in the homeland.
Thank you. We'll zoom out a bit now. I think what's not often discussed, and we spoke about this a little bit before the interview, is maybe the wider historical context. So the Nakba in 1947-48 involved hundreds of thousands of Palestinians being forced from their homeland. To what extent can these events of 1948 be explained by the actions taken in Palestine beforehand, and maybe in the decades before that?
You mean before the Nakba?
Before the Nakba. So in the decades before the Nakba, how much of that can be explained by the political situation happening in historical Palestine, but maybe also from the US and the UK?
You know, everything can only be explained by that, because everything else is only a symptom of what happened 107 years ago, or even a bit more. What happened to the Palestinian people is the worst that could ever happen to a people, the worst, which is the complete and utter cancellation of a nation. And what a nation, not any other nation. We just started by saying how rooted, how historic it is in every sense, the birthplace of major civilizations and what have you. And in one go came a mindset, a supremacist mindset, a settler colonial mindset, here from the West, whereby Palestine has become from the most ancient rooted of civilizations, from a people that are very well known throughout history to be right in the middle of all these civilizations and a minaret in every sense, Jerusalem, Beit Lahem, what have you, Yaffa, and exportation of oranges. Yaffa used to export oranges to the UK more than the UK would export to Palestine. The net trade was in our benefit. And the Yaffa, the Java oranges were historically famous before 1948 and before the creation of Israel. And our industries, our arts, I mean, Palestine was home to the most sort of sophisticated art. Before the events, you would have the most prominent Arab and regional artists, singers, cinema actors, what have you, in all around the main cities of Palestine, Haifa, Akka, Yaffa, the coastal cities, and Gaza. And Gaza was a key sort of historic place right in the middle of civilizations. It's the link between Africa, Asia, and Europe. I mean, Cyprus is only a few miles away. So they turned all that into a people without a land.
How, Hussam? How did that happen before 1948?
The power of ideology and the power of propaganda and the power of narratives.
Okay.
Whereby the Zionist ideology was, this is...
Could you maybe be precise then if we can talk about the central tenets of Zionism, both in the past and present, and how that influences things?
The very idea that this is a land without a people, this is a desert, completely empty, and that for that desert to bloom, we need to engage in an act of promising a homeland for another people that will come and make that desert bloom. That's classic settler colonialism mindset, ideology, trying to justify acts of colonialism, acts of ethnic cleansing, acts of displacement and replacement. But that was aided and helped by Great Britain at the time, the Balfour Declaration, which, if you go back and read, was the biggest injustice, historic injustice in the history of nations. I mean, these 67 words by the Foreign Secretary at the time, Lord Balfour, literally promised our land without consulting us and turned us, the indigenous population that have lived there for millennia, into non-Jewish minorities. So we were defined as non-Jewish minorities, when in fact at the time we were 96% of the population owning the majority of the land and the property and what have you. We became non-Jewish minorities. So we were defined by who we are not, not by who we are.
Thank you. I'm just going to move on to the UK's role in a second with the Balfour Declaration, but other things. But before that, I just want to ask you about how you square the use of language, such as, for example, settler colonialism, colonization, and so on, with your role as an ambassador for the PA, who officially recognizes the Oslo Accords. And part of the Oslo Accords is the official recognition by the PLO of Israel as a legitimate state. Is there not a disjunct between your language of colonization and overtake and a land without people with that official recognition which you are supposed to push and to speak about?
First of all, I represent the state of Palestine, and the government of the state of Palestine is the PLO that represents all Palestinians inside and outside of Palestine. And the PLO is the sole legitimate, recognized as such entity by the international community. That's why the office here in London is the PLO office. The office I used to head as an ambassador in the US was the PLO office.
Just to clarify for our viewers, that doesn't include Hamas, correct?
No, the PLO, no. The PLO does not include Hamas, but the PLO includes all other main Palestinian political factions. The Palestinian Authority was established by the PLO to undertake certain responsibilities under the PLO's commitment of the Oslo Accords. However, there is a big difference between narratives and history and reality. that you have to be absolutely clear about. What happened to Palestine in the 19th century, starting with the conference in Basel and all that happened since then, the Balfour Declaration soon after, the British Mandate, and then the establishment of the State of Israel on the bones of the Palestinian people was a classic case of colonial enterprise. It's a settler colonialism.
Yes, so just to clarify something, then, if you don't mind, the acceptance of the Oslo Accords, which from the PLO officially recognizes the State of Israel, in your view, that's purely pragmatic on the basis of geopolitical reality, and yet you will still claim ultimately that the creation of Israel was a settler colonial project and therefore not legitimate. Is that right?
No, that's not right. What is right here is that we have to define the issue as it is. And the issue is an issue of settler colonialism, okay? And no one should rewrite history, because there was a lot of lies about what has been happening and what happened in 1948, before it and after it. What happened was a classic case of a project that came to replace the indigenous population. And to replace the indigenous population, you needed to use classic tools of colonial, settler colonialism. And that is exactly what happened. However, a political solution is something different. And you need to make the difference, the distinction between a homeland and a state. I started by telling you I represent the state of Palestine. A homeland is a homeland. When my father took me to his village, showed me his house, showed me the fig tree he planted, that is my homeland. No one will take that away. No one can take that away. Mm. But a state is a different matter. Mm. Yes, the PLO has accepted a state after Israel ends its military occupation that began in 1967. That is the West Bank, including Jerusalem and Gaza, of course. We have accepted that, and we have accepted international resolutions. But that is towards a political solution. But the homeland includes all of Palestine.
Okay.
And no one. We would be flexible in finding a political solution, because in the end, we are oriented by protecting our next children. We want to find the solution. And we have been very flexible in accepting the international formula. And by the way, let me explain this to you, Oli. Very important. Many people think the two-state solution is a Palestinian demand. Wrong. The two-state solution is a Palestinian concession. We have accepted the international formula, even though many of our people thought that that was unfair to accept to establish a state on 22% of historic Palestine. But we have accepted it because we accept the premise of international legitimacy and legality. We accept the premise of a post-World War II global order, rules-based global order. But that does not in any way or shape change the truth, the facts of the homeland and what happened to the homeland.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about the UK then. Of course, you're the head of the Palestinian mission to the UK. As you said, the UK officially signed off the Balfour Declaration in 1917. That was fully legitimized in 22. And then in 1947, you spoke about the rules-based world order. The UN partition plan was put in place. However, even before that vote was fully put through, the UK announced that they would be leaving in mid-May 1948, which essentially left disorder for the war to occur instead of putting in the partition plan in an ordered way. So as the ambassador to the UK, how does that inform your role and how does it make you feel about the state of Palestine's relation to the UK?
It's a mixed feeling. It's really a mixed feeling. When I was appointed first, and I knew I will be serving as an ambassador here, the first feeling, I am being sent to the land of Balfour, to the place that has contributed to the agony of my people and myself. I am the result, the outcome, the son of that declaration and then that mandate. I mean, the consequences of that mandate, on the one hand. But on the other hand, that's where the feeling is mixed. I had lived in the UK before as a student, like you do now, and I had studied here at the LSE in the late 90s. And I stayed a few years doing a PhD as well afterwards. And I have come to close proximity, not with the history or the governments, but with the people of the UK. And that's what was in my mind, that perhaps because of the people of the UK, because of how sophisticated the British people are, how exposed, very well read, I always believe that where it started, and started here, the cancellation process started here, where it started, it might end. And it gives me so much strength when I see this is happening and materializing in front of my eyes. When I see a million people, British people in the streets in support of Palestine against the genocide. When I see these people coming every week, not only in London, but all over the UK. When I link this to the anti-apartheid movement of the 80s to free South Africa and to end the apartheid regime there and to free Nelson Mandela. And when I know that history teaches us that the epicenter of that global anti-apartheid movement was London. And when I see that the same global movement is happening for Palestine here. And when I remember the saying of Nelson Mandela at the time, the freedom of South Africa is incomplete without the freedom of Palestine. When I link all these things together, it fills my heart with hope that perhaps, yes, the UK and the people of the UK particularly could help end this whole injustice where it all started.
Thank you, Hussam. Obviously, the West, right, has a certain relationship with both the Palestinians, but also with the Jewish people. So I think it's undeniable that in the early 20th century, the West treated the Jews unacceptably, from multiple pogroms in Eastern Europe to, most centrally, the Holocaust. So it is also undeniable that this is what created support for the foundation of Israel. Truman's advisor, for example, told him that it is a moral obligation of the Americans to support the Jewish people, just bringing it to the Holocaust. So this is obviously a two-sided story of Palestinians and the Jewish people and Israelis. How crucial is the Holocaust in understanding both the history of Israel, but also their current national psyche?
It's very crucial. And anti-Semitism here in the West, in Europe particularly, against the Jewish people is dark and one of the most evil acts that any people could have gone through. I mean, to be targeted only because of who you are. And the Holocaust is the most heinous crime in modern history, by far. We, the Palestinian people, because of the situation we have gone through, really do feel how a people could feel being targeted only for their identity. And Europe is guilty of years and decades and centuries of anti-Semitism and targeting the Jewish people for being Jewish. Absolutely. And this evil has to be uprooted, completely uprooted. Anti-Semitism does hurt our issue, our cause. Our cause has nothing to do with the Jewish people. Has nothing to do with the Jewish people. In fact, I've just mentioned the support here and the solidarity and the demos. Go and find out. You will find many of them are Jewish people who are Jewish brothers and sisters who participate in all these demos, in campaigns that happened in Oxford,
yes,
your university. I went and I met many of them are Jewish students. So this is not a religious conflict between Jews and Muslims or Jews and Christians. This is a political conflict. And if you look now deeper, you will find out that the biggest number of Zionists are not Jews, actually. The biggest number of Zionists are Christians, the Christian Zionist movement and the evangelical movement. So we will need to make sure of that. And having said all that, and to truly fight an uproot anti-Semitism, we will need to not conflate it with being against the Israeli policies, against a state policy, a government policy. I mean, it is absolutely ridiculous to assume that the Palestinian issue has anything to do with the guilt has anything to do with the anti-Semitism as a very vile phenomena. Our issue has nothing to do with that.
But it is interlinked. You do agree?
It shouldn't be interlinked whatsoever.
There is a causal relationship between the post-Holocaust movement of the Jews into Palestine and the current conflict, right? And that was caused partly due to a certain guilt from the West. The question is partly, was that the Jewish people were left without a home. I'm not saying that what happened was what was supposed to happen, but could you have seen perhaps a realistic mass integration of Jewish people into Palestine where they would co-inhabit it?
It's best that the West and Europe should have fought and fought harder anti-Semitism and allowed the Jewish people to live wherever they want to live. Because there are so many Jewish people who want to be British and French and, you know, what have you, and live in these countries. And there are millions of them. So it's best to actually make sure that the phenomenon of anti-Semitism is fought and fought hard and uprooted. Because the real issue is here. The issue of anti-Semitism is here. It's not in the East. And the East, including Palestine, have been historically known for coexistence and tolerance. I mean, Palestine had many Palestinian Jews in it before 1948. They were part of our nation. They were part of our national fabric and social fabric. And we have coexisted for millennia without any issues. The issues are here in the West, but the conflation has got to stop.
Nonetheless, though, if you don't mind me saying, pre-1948, this is not to lay specific responsibility on either side. However, there were tensions before 1948 and before the Holocaust, right? For example, with the Great Revolt of 1936 to 1939. And so there seems to have been a problem with coexistence to some extent in historical Palestine, even before the foundation of Israel. So how should we look at that?
Yeah, but that event or the Great Strike in 1936 was primarily when the Palestinian people got to realize that what was coming their way is a campaign of ethnic cleansing. What was coming their way was a classic settler colonialism a project that would end displacing them and replacing them. And this is exactly what happened. But before all these events, before the Palestinian people came to the realization of that, the Palestinian people, be it Christians, Muslims, or Jews, were living. Of course, there are incidents here and there, of course, that should be fought and should be stopped. But by and large, they lived together as communities in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, and everywhere, in a way that one could explain to be exemplary and to be a model for what should come in the future. But the key issue here about anti-Semitism as a plague that should be uprooted is that, you know, those who conflate it argue that a ridiculous idea that had our oppressors been non-Jewish, we would have been okay with it. Nonsense. This is not about them being Jewish. This is about them being occupiers, colonizers, besiegers. So, and them is not just Jewish. In the Israeli army, there are Muslim soldiers, there are Christian soldiers. So this is not about the identity of our oppressors. This is about the fact of our oppression. Can I make that point even more clear? This isn't about the identity of our oppressors. This is about the fact of our oppression. What is at stake here is the oppression, and what we are struggling against is against the oppression, no matter the identity of the oppressor.
But I do just want to focus in, because I think nonetheless, I think a lot of it has to do with identity, right? I mean, pre-1882, you know, the Jewish population in Palestine was something like less than 1%, right? And Israel now, the argument from the PLO is, also displaces and excludes Palestinians on the basis of race and identity. Many Israeli organizations affirm their Jewishness as a key element of what's going on here. And we talk about an Israeli-Arab conflict more widely. So I think it would be inaccurate to not allow identity to play part of the story and try and help that explain what's going on here, surely.
Well, the moment you start thinking in supremacist terms, the moment you start thinking that, you know, only a certain identity, a certain ethnicity has rights, exclusive rights, a certain ethnicity has claims on the entire land, is a moment when, you know, you get us to where we are today. What we need to see is that everybody realize that, you know, things must be shared, rights must be achieved and granted equally. There are no discrimination, there are no better people than others. We are all the children of God. We are all chosen in some way. And in any political arrangement, we all must be protected by the same law, the same constitution. That's the issue. And that's exactly what started and came our way. What came our way was not a group of people who want to live in the middle of us and with us. And by the way, Palestine historically was open to people coming and going. I mean, we are. And many stories of Jewish people who were prosecuted in Europe came to Palestine before the events, and they were received with open arms. The story is when you start thinking that you want to have exclusive rights. When you think like the current Israeli fanatical ministers with Netanyahu himself fanatical, who really believe in such a mindset of supremacy that they have a divine right to discriminate against us. There we have a problem. And we have a problem of using the Bible, and we are the people of the Bible. Remember, Palestine is the birthplace of Christianity. It was in Bethlehem. Using the Bible, weaponizing the Bible against us, as if God has given land and God was a state agent distributing land. God doesn't do that. God gives land to people equally, and God looks at all people equally. So this is the issue, and the issue has been allowed to fester and fester from the time of the establishment of Israel all the way to the Smotrich and the Ben-Gvir and what is happening, which is the actual settler movement taking hold of Israel now. The settler movement inside the occupied territory, inside the West Bank, completely taking over. And the Kahanists, who were designated in the US as a terrorist group only a couple of decades ago, now they are sitting on the cabinet table inside Israel. So this is the real issue, my friend. This is it's not just about how do we find a formula for people to exist. It's how do we fight and defeat the zero-sum mentality and the zero-sum mindset.
Thank you. Before we move on to the final section of the interview, I just wanted to quickly pick up on one point, just back to the Holocaust, where you mentioned that the solution should have been some sort of cohabitants of Jewish people post-Holocaust in Europe. And correct me if this is a misrepresentation of your point, but do you not think that by asking the Jewish people to remain in the lands in which they were discriminated against and in which mass genocide was committed against them, do you not think that that's also a lot to ask?
I didn't say that. I said the solution was to uproot anti-Semitism, to fight anti-Semitism, to make sure that the Jewish people are protected everywhere, not just in one place. And that is the responsibility of the Western governments. And that was that responsibility during the horrific unspeakable crimes against the Jewish people throughout history, but particularly during the most heinous of crimes, the Holocaust, should have prompted governments and systems in the West to focus on the root cause of the issue. The root cause of the issue is the hatred to Jews. The root cause of the issue here in Europe and in the West is anti-Semitism. And therefore, it is, yes, it is, to make sure that Jewish people exist wherever they are with protection and without hatred. But the idea that they only can exist in one land and then the land has its inhabitant population without any regard to the indigenous population have created this unresolved conflict.
I agree.
The Jewish people have the right to be protected and live safely everywhere they are. And I lived in the U.S. long enough to know that there are more Jews in the U.S. than in Israel now. So what do you do with them? So the Jewish people in the U.S. or in Europe have no protection, no rights. And we don't fight anti-Semitism because now they have an exclusive place for the Jewish people. All what we're saying is the West has not dealt with its issues. And then we have become the victims of the victims. We, the Palestinian people, have become the victims of the victims. Now, who are the original victims is the Jewish people. And now we are the victims of the victims. But who is the victimizer? Was it the Palestinian people that did the horrible, heinous crime of the Holocaust? Who did all these crimes and the pogroms? It was here in the West. And therefore, the victimizer has got to have leadership and be true and come up with a realization about the crimes that have been committed against the Jewish people and resolve it and challenge it rather than just export it on others and not deal with it.
Yeah, so just to finish off, I want to talk about the two-state solution that you're advocating for. I think the way that the PLO and the way that Israel officially or non-officially views the two-state solution is quite different. The West Bank is separated into different enclaves. You have Zone A, B, C. The PLO only have control of one part of that. There's different settler enclaves in the West Bank. And for example, Smotrich was talking about the annexation of Gaza. So what does a two-state solution look like to you? And how can you work with an Israel which is basically unwilling to remove settlements in West Bank, as previously stated?
No, Israel is unwilling to do anything. And Israel doesn't want a two-state solution, doesn't want a one-state solution, doesn't want any solution. Israel wants a repeat of what they did in 1948, and they are doing it now in Gaza, and they are doing it in a slower fashion in the West Bank. So there is depopulation in Gaza, there is depopulation in the West Bank. The current Israeli political thinking and political class is not where you want them to be vis-a-vis a solution. What we need to do is to recreate the power dynamics and redraw the lines and create leverage so we actually implement a solution rather than call for a solution or negotiate a solution, because we've done enough of calling and enough of negotiating. Having said all that, you know, if you really want to know what is a solution and what could be a solution, just visit the ruling, the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice only a few months ago in July. That is the highest court on the globe. That's not any other court. Those are the judges of the world. And they came up with a very clear verdict whereby Israel's presence in the occupied territory is unlawful. Because, by the way, there are some military occupations that could be deemed in a temporary manner as lawful. This is unlawful, the international court said. It has to end. Israel's colonial settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem are unlawful and must be dismantled, all of them. And these settlers must go back. And thirdly, all third states must cease immediately to provide any political, legal, or material support for Israel's illegal practices. If we look at that ruling, we'll understand that the solution lies there. Lies first with the third parties to ensure that Israel does not do this. They do not support. And Israel cannot do all what it can do without the West support. It can't without the U.S. bombs that they provide, these 2,000 pounds bombs that drops on the heads of families and neighborhoods in Gaza and in Lebanon and elsewhere. This is the solution. Israel's occupation has got to end. A state of Palestine is established with Jerusalem its capital, all of East Jerusalem its capital. A resolution to the issue of refugees in according with international legality and legitimacy. And Palestinians have the right to be treated equally wherever they are, wherever they live, equally. Discrimination must end against the Palestinians. And that will provide a solution, yes.
Thank you. I want to clarify for our listeners, yes, the settlements are illegal under international law, and not much is being done about that. Officially speaking, as recorded by international organizations, more than 40,000 Palestinians have died during this conflict, with an estimated 160,000 due to indirect deaths. What is going on in Gaza is very troubling. Hussam, thank you so much for coming on. Before we finish, I'd like you to tell us something you want the world to know about the Palestinian people.
Well, the one thing that the Palestinian people need to be known for is that they have been a force of good for humanity at large for millennia. And, you know, wherever you go in Palestine, you have the huge story of there is Jesus Christ was born. There, Abraham, the father of all prophets, lived there. It's a very storied and ancient land. And the Palestinian people, despite the most adverse situation that they have gone through, a process of cancellation, they were literally gone in the eyes of many players around them. And the consequences was actual extermination. Despite all that, the Palestinian people have managed to create one of the highest education levels. We have one of the lowest illiteracy rates in the region, if not in the world. We have the highest per capita PhD graduates worldwide, one of which is the one you're talking to. And I remember I started in a tent in a refugee camp. That's because this society invests so much in us. And this society invests so much in the good and in the potential and the possibilities. Look at the Palestinian refugees and the diaspora community in other places. Look at them in Gulf countries. Look at them all over the world. Look how many Palestinians there are in leading positions in the banking sector and the high tech. Wherever I go now as Palestinian, you know what? Every time I go to a hospital, there is a Palestinian consultant there. The last time I counted, there is 550 Palestinian senior medical consultants in the NHS only. And I tell you, that's not the whole list. And that goes everywhere. So such a people who have been able to do this despite all that, can you imagine? Can you begin to imagine how Palestine will become a light upon nations and how Palestine will become such a force of good and how that will create a different dynamics regionally and globally should Palestine be free and should this oppression ends and should this injustice finishes and should people be able to truly, truly utilize their full potential. And I tell you, the potential of the Palestinian people is limitless. Limitless. Remember the story of NASA where they invented for the first time a rover that lands on Mars, a helicopter that lands on Mars. I found out that the person who actually invented that Mars rover was a Palestinian from Gaza who sat next to me when we were in high school some 30 years ago. So, and you know what? To come out of Gaza and of the refugee experience and to go all the way to NASA, I think the 14 million Palestinians would be that should the opportunity be given. So do not just remember the Palestinian people by these horrific scenes of killings against them and our children being murdered, but also think of Palestinian people that would be such an asset to humanity once they shake off all the dust, the historic dust and the current dust from their very tired shoulders.
Thank you, Hussam. I think this has been a good debate. And while we may have got a bit heated at points, I really appreciate you coming, talking to Oli and I, and the work that you're doing is so important and it's really moving for me, to be honest, to hear you speak. I think it's a very, very complex issue, which is why we wanted to talk about complex things. But you've laid it out in a way that I think all viewers would find very hard to disagree with. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thank you very much. Hey guys, we just wanted to sit down and have a chat about how the interview went and our outtakes. Lucas, how did you find it?
I thought it was powerful. I think there's no denying that whatever side of the political spectrum you sit on, he's a powerful guy.
Yeah. I mean, let's start by saying how nice he was when he walked in, you know, complimented the studio and everything, you know, asked us questions about us. He had a really positive energy. And I think for me, something he does, which is partially due to his position and the country he's advocating for, is that he's very, like, very clear. And I think many ambassadors use pre-existent lines and say things, you know, these tropes which they have to push, but you know, he's willing to talk about the emotion and he's willing to state very clearly where he's at.
Yeah, do you think he over-romanticized the pre-1948 situation in historic Palestine?
Yeah, I think, I tried to push on that. There's a certain extent to which he wanted to give an idea, which is not entirely untrue, you know, of this peaceful place. It does have high religious significance. It has been a connection for continents, you know, across thousands of years. Nonetheless, from the reading we did, the Great Revolt was one thing.
He did kind of brush the Great Arab Revolt aside, right, to be fair. He called them, like, there are these incidents that need to be resolved, but then he kind of like had that as a footnote rather than like,
sure,
as yeah, maybe other historians in yeah, general might put a more more of a focus on that as like central yeah, the geopolitical developments.
I think he wanted to kind of say that 1948 essentially was the beginning of history in a way. And like the, you know, from 1882 up until 1948, the Jewish population expanded from something like a few thousand to a few hundred thousand, right? And that is something, seeing that development, I think is important. And it may actually, you know, be positive for how we look at the conflict or be positive for how we look at the Palestinian cause or not.
Yeah, I think he did kind of like skirt around some of the point I was trying to make, in that I was trying to ask him about pre-1948 and how that led to the events of that year. I think to some extent he maybe skirted around that. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But, you know, I think as an ambassador, it sort of makes sense, right? I mean, what he's trying to do, as well as stay true to the facts, is like build a national story. And I think that kind of narrative, which we were introducing, maybe complicates it a bit too much from the point of view of somebody who's trying to.
We do try to complicate point. Narratives, though. Isn't like part of the whole.
Yeah.
Critique of the war that it is just charged by narrative largely. Mm. Oh, this is the October 7th hostage narrative, for example, is one line that like is taken.
Yeah. It's interesting to note, I guess, like from the discussions we had before, why we didn't talk about October 7th too much.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you can say your viewpoint like in full, but for me it was really that, you know, recognizing the significance and the horror of October 7th. Nonetheless, it is sort of almost exclusively, you know, one of the first questions that gets asked to people who advocate for the Palestinian cause in general. Of course, he's the ambassador. He would have had that a lot. And so that's why I think we tried to push back pre-1948 in terms of Palestinian reaction more generally, as opposed to October 7th, which, you know, seems like something that's said a lot.
I think it is the case that October 7th is just fundamentally such an important part of this history and the development and the war. But the entire conflict didn't start on October 7th, and it's just been a little overdone, that line, do you condemn Hamas? Do you condemn October 7th? That we kind of felt that the pushback would have led to a certain dead end, or maybe an end that's been extremely, extremely explored, which is good, but I feel like people have the resources to hear his opinion on those matters if they want to. We kind of wanted to maybe shift the focus a little bit, maybe a historical context. I think we did that fairly well.
And I mean, I think there's also a problematic implication in the specific way it's asked, and that's why it can get taken like that, is that there's somehow kind of a synergy between an organization like the PLO, which has been a peaceful for a very long time, and Hamas. And it creates a false unity. And there's an implication in the question about the fact that these atrocities, which were absolutely horrific, are in some way symbolic of the Palestinian national consciousness and approach in general. And that's what I think it's important to disentangle, is that this is one, nevertheless, with sway. The support of Hamas is one movement in the Palestinian people. And the events of October 7th, whilst undeniably horrific, don't represent the Palestinian people as a general. I think that's what's really important to note.
Do you think me and you kind of differ on our opinion on the conflict at all? Or to what extent do we differ?
It's a difficult question. I don't know. Where do you think we differ? Since you're asking, but I could.
Yeah, I think to some extent, maybe you focus more on like the structural aspect of things. So you'd focus more on, this is the colonial settler framework that led to October 7th, for example. Whereas I'm more likely to focus on something like, these are the current events in Israel, in Gaza. This is what we need to focus on, the current geopolitical situation. Which is, I think there are different like pros and cons to those approaches. Yeah.
I think, well,
I don't know if I'm being clear.
No, you're being clear. There's something we didn't get into fully, but something I think is so important in the general discussion about Israel and Palestine, right, is the language used. Zomlot made a good point when he said, you know, people talk about the two-state solution as something Palestinians actively advocate for. It's actually a Palestinian concession, right? And that's a linguistic difference, which ultimately is expressing the same event, right? Or expressing the same thing. And yet that frames it very differently. And I think framing these things with the right approach is important, right? And talking about, you know, early Zionist thought, right, did use colonial language. And so as much as it has developed and it doesn't use that language and that isn't the mindset anymore, nonetheless, it's important to frame it in those terms, since the narrative determines how people act and how they think about these issues and so how things unfold.
It's interesting, as part of that October 7th debate, where you have to realize and recognize the actions of what happened.
100%.
I'm not saying that you're denying that. It's the actions of what happened, and that some people might find that talking about language in that scenario is almost irrelevant. And this is maybe to some extent.
And I think that actually allows us to frame it and understand it in the right way. I do understand. And look, I think there should be a focus on October 7th, right? It should be talked about. Sort of my point is that I think it's been done in the wrong way, you know, almost too much to the point where it's difficult to talk about now in the right way because of the associations. And it's really difficult to disentangle talking about October 7th and the horror of October 7th without associating yourself with the line that is pushed, do you condemn X? And I think that's why we try to stay away, right?
It is, to some extent, I'm probably more likely to see a value in that question. Do you condemn Hamas? I think to some extent, it is an important question.
Yeah.
Maybe not to ask Hussam Zomlot. He obviously does condemn the actions of what happened. So that's why maybe we felt it wasn't the right avenue to go down. But I think there is value in that question because 100%. You're basically asking someone to stake a position where they're condemning another party, right? Who is to some extent on the same front against the colonizer.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I just think it's got to do with the way it's been asked. But let's move on from that. It was a really interesting distinction he had between the language he used about colonialism and oppression, right? And the fact that he accepted the Oslo Accords. You know, there's still a little bit of a dissonance for me. And other ambassadors, for example, delegates to the UN, would be much more hesitant to say, I officially recognize the state of Israel due to the post-Second World War order. And because of the geopolitical reality, and yet nonetheless, he maintains the narrative that basically the creation of Israel is a colonial project, right? And there is a dissonance there, which I think he did distinguish well, talking about Palestine as the homeland versus Palestine the state. And yet it's interesting that somebody in the PLO is able to do that when, speaking as an official, you should speak in the capacity of somebody who officially recognizes what has been stated by your organization. Yeah,
there was like a distinction that he was drawing between the emotional, so the connection to historic Palestine versus like the pragmatic, the realpolitik of the situation. But it is interesting that he was almost conceding that facts on the ground can have like real world effects and that they have created what he calls an official state of Israel.
I think he pushed over the settler question a bit too quickly. I think in order to seem hopeful about a two-state solution, in order to push a positive message. But, you know, the Likud coalition, which Netanyahu currently runs, has, you know, a large faction from the religious party, the RP, without which Netanyahu's coalition would crumble. And it's that party on that issue, which does not accept the removal of any settlements from the West Bank. And so I think maybe Zomlot wanted to brush it over to maintain a positive message since it's not directly in negotiations. But that is going to be way more complicated because I don't think people in the West Bank probably will accept settlements as part of a two-state solution. That's going to be way more complicated than probably he put it across.
So I think one thing which we do need to also briefly discuss is that we got a little bit heated at one point. The discussion got a little bit heated when we discussed the Holocaust. Obviously, for him, it's a difficult topic to navigate. There's no skirting around that. But I think he did it well. I think he explained his position quite well. I don't know what you think about it, but I feel like the Israeli national psyche in relation to the Holocaust is that important point.
Yeah. I think there's a problem, right? Because the framing of the question, as we put it, was what role does it play, right, in the narrative about Israel-Palestine? That's the important question for me. And what role does it play in explaining, you know, the support which accrued for the foundation of Israel in the West and how the West treated Jews in general? Now, I think the problem for him is that as somebody who advocates on behalf of PLO, any statement can quite easily be taken out of context. And he told us that that does happen.
Post-interview, so, he told us that he didn't want to be taken out of context in relation to what he was saying.
And, you know, he was very authentic in the fact that he thought it was horrific and that anti-Semitism is still has increased and is a huge problem in Europe. And I think, you know, his point that nonetheless, we should seek to resolve that in Europe in the present day is important, right? And to not abstract from that. So I think...
I think the main disagreement that came there was that to some extent, well, I mean, firstly, just to preface it, he is a diplomat. He needs to just be careful about what he says.
Mm.
So there was that element that mm-hmm. you could tell he was not only thinking about what to say, but thinking about how what he was going to say would come across. I think there's that element that he is a face for the Palestinians. But again, I don't think there was necessarily a disagreement with him. It is a question of, to some extent, what importance do you place on that as one of the factors leading to the foundation mm-hmm. of Israel and to the events of 1948? And maybe we didn't go into it into enough detail, but I think it was important to bring up in any case.
Yeah, no, definitely. Let's finish by talking about the political reality on the ground right now. Smotrich, the finance minister, has said he wants to annex Gaza in 2025. There's a lot going on. The war has continued for well over a year now. Where do you see this going? Where do you see it ending? I don't know.
I'd be lying, I think, if I claim to have an answer. I don't, and no one has a specific answer. I think there is a pragmatic approach to this. Let's have the ceasefires. Let's prevent people from dying as much as possible. And this is a point that Zomlott's made in other interviews. And then only once there are ceasefires in place and it's not just people killing other people, humans killing other humans, then you can have diplomatic discussions.
Yeah.
And he's willing to say that Palestine must not, or the Palestinian people must not now try and take huge amounts of land back. He
advocates for the Oslo or post-Oslo Accords agreement.
He's whatever side you're sitting on, if you believe that this land should be inhabited by Israeli nationals, if it should be inhabited by Palestinians, let's say some land in between, some parts of Jerusalem, who should take which part. To some extent, the exact way in which those lines are drawn is not the most relevant point.
It's a post-conflict discussion,
right?
The
most relevant point now, I think, at least in my mind, when what I'm seeing on the news every day is just stopping the deaths. This is unnecessary deaths. It's just that is why it was so great to talk to him as well, to hear his opinion on that.
Here's the thing from my perspective is, there was something like 1,000 deaths on October 7th. The Israeli need for security and to get the hostages back is obviously strong. My issue comes with the narrative from Likud and from Netanyahu's government that they're doing everything they can to get back the hostages when there's been multiple attempts at a ceasefire deal, ones which Hamas have accepted, which would include the return of the hostages, right? And we see, you know, a powerful state with one of the strongest intelligence services in the world going around a territory they control, needing to destroy hospitals to... with so many deaths in order to find these hostages, it doesn't seem realistic to me that it's the main objective at this current moment.
And then the larger question, which I don't claim to have the answer to, is how do you free these hostages? And at the same time, how do you bring justice to the Palestinian people who are living in some of the most awful conditions imaginable?
Yeah, I mean, we discussed the extent shortly at the end of the interview with Zomlott. But maybe that's a point where we slightly disagree, is that I think, at least from the point of view of the campaign that Netanyahu is doing, moving refugees around, et cetera, the unnecessary killing. For me, it seems that despite the Israeli national consciousness in general being, you know, seeing the return of the hostages is highly important, I don't personally think that Netanyahu is being fully authentic with regards to his aims and what he's trying to do in Gaza. But guys, thank you so much for listening in. This has been Critical Edge. This is our first podcast with our new name. We're really excited. We're looking to bring critical discussions, challenging guests, not shying away from controversial topics. And we want to bring you guys along with us in this journey to learn how to think, not what to think. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe, and we'll see you next time.